Today is January 26, 2012. It's a meeting of the House Special Committee on Energy, called to order. Let the record reflect that it is 3:04 p.m. And for the record, we do have a chair, quorum. We do have Representative
Peterson.
Pete Peterson. There you go. Yeah, that works there. Representative Chris Tuck, Representative Olson, Representative Pruitt, and myself, Representative Foster. And in the audience, do we have any? Oh, and incoming here, we have Representative Dan Sadler. At this time, I'd like to remind everybody, if you do have a cell phone on you, if you could silence that. The purpose of today's meeting is to get a progress report of the Alaska Energy Authority's project, specifically those authorized by SB 42. And I would like to introduce Sarah Fisher Goad. She is the Executive Director of the Alaska Energy Authority. And Sarah, if you could restate your name and also maybe introduce your staff that you have with you here.
For the record, my name is Sarah Fisher Goad. I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Energy Authority. It's nice to be back in Juneau and in front of the House Energy Committee. Senate Bill 42 that the governor introduced and passed last year had the Alaska Energy Authority in a very busy interim. And I would like to introduce the staff that we have here with us and a couple folks online that are available for questions. Mr. Wayne Dyock. He's our project manager, and he's going to be doing the presentation today. So if Wayne could come to the table, please. And then Emily Ford is our public outreach liaison for the project. And she and Wayne have tried to get to each of your offices to at least introduce themselves to your staff and drop off our annual report. Online, Brian Carey, the engineering manager for the project, is available for questions. Brian Bjorkvist from the Department of Law. And we also have our FERC licensing attorneys online, Mike Swiger and Tom Roberts. So they're there for questions in case they come up. And before Wayne starts his presentation, I did just want to recognize when we wanted to make sure that we sought out a very, very qualified project manager to move this very important project forward. And it was a real pleasure to interview and work on hiring Wayne. He's got over 35 years of experience in project licensing and engineering. In particular, he has experience on this project from the late 70s and the early 80s. So he comes with history on the project. And I think one of the things that I was very impressed when Wayne and I first spoke was he felt it was coming back to Alaska to finish a job that started several years ago. So I think that perspective is very well appreciated, and me and our board of directors are very, very pleased with respect to having Wayne on board to kind of lead this effort. So with that, I'm going to man the PowerPoint, and Wayne will take it from there.
For the record, my name is Wayne Dyock. I'm with the Alaska Energy Authority, and I am the project manager for the Susitna-Wetana project. This afternoon, I'd like to give you a synopsis of the project and a little brief background of what we've accomplished over the past year, but perhaps most importantly, where we're going. The first slide, if you look to the map, it shows the Susitna-Wetana project location. The yellow line to the left of the Susitna Wetana project is the intertie. The project itself is at River Mile 184 on the Susitna River above Devil's Canyon. We're looking at a dam that's going to be approximately 700 feet high. It would have a reservoir 39 miles long, approximately 2 miles wide at its widest. Perhaps one of the more important parts of the description here is that the project will be providing approximately half of the rail belt energy demand. We're looking at an installed capacity in the order of 600 megawatts and around 2.5 million megawatt hours of annual energy production. The project would have a life exceeding 100 years, and it would provide long-term stable electric rates. The next slide, you know, shows you the location relative to River Miles. As you can see, Wetana in the blue up at River Mile 184, you certainly have area of a length of river upstream of that. The purple part, which we're calling the middle river, is where primarily where the impacts would take place, and that goes down to the confluence of the Chulitna, Talkeetna, and Susitna rivers, which is around River Mile, you know, 98. The green part there is the lower river. We're actually going to be conducting some studies that go all the way down to Cook Inlet, but the primary effects would be in that middle river reach. We're sort of honing in on the project area. This next slide shows the three access corridors that we're considering. The one going from the Denali Highway, we're calling the Denali Corridor. It goes from, you know, north to south. And then the two east-west corridors, there's the Chulitna Corridor. That's, you know, north of the Susitna River. And the one south of the Susitna River is called the Gold Creek Corridor. These corridors would house the access road and a transmission line, and we may need a second transmission line route as well for reliability purposes. As we continue to hone in, this is a map showing the project area itself. You see the Wetana Dam and powerhouse in the river itself, and the reservoir backed up behind it. You can see some of the roads and access corridors. Shows the permanent camp, and we'll have a temporary camp. We'll have an airstrip, and then you'll see some, you know, quarry areas, you know, there in different locations. This next one, getting closer and closer here, shows the conceptual, you know, site plan. The dam itself is the centerpiece here. Right now, we're showing it going straight across. One of the things that we're going to be looking at is probably putting in a little bit of curvature to that dam. We might be able to save 20% on materials. Upstream of the dam itself is the diversion structure, and then you have to have a small diversion structure on the downstream. You see some roads in there, and then we would have to, before we start construction, be able to put a diversion around the dam to put the flow through, and then, you know, that's how we would control the water and have an area that's dry so we can do the construction. Okay. We get into the real important part here now of what this product would provide to people within the state of Alaska. We've conducted some preliminary studies to this point in time. One of the principal objectives is to really make sure we have energy for the principal part of the year that it's needed, and that's from the November through you know, April period when it's coldest here, and that's when we need most of the energy. One of the aspects associated with that is we're going to need to meet some minimum flows for environmental purposes. Those are the studies that we're, some of the studies that we're going to be conducting in the next few years to really get a better handle on what those minimum flows you know, should be. A starting point was what we did in the early 1980s. We also want to maximize the power generation you know, during the summer period as well, but keeping in mind that you want to have a full reservoir by the time you get into the fall period when you have your firm power requirements. And, you know, the goal here clearly is to generate power to meet the electric rail belt demand. This particular figure shows over a 24-hour period what we're anticipating the energy demand to be like in the rail belt. The scale on the left is megawatts. It's not the peak megawatt day. The peak megawatt would be probably somewhere over, you know, 900, but it would be a typical day. So you can see how power fluctuates, where it goes down in the morning, comes up, or overnight, comes up in the morning and kind of stays there, and then you have the evening peak, and then it falls. What we would like to do in operation is to provide a load following mode for the project that allows the gas-fired plants that are online and other generation to really run on a constant basis, because that's your most cost-effective way to do that. So we would like to have the ability to fluctuate the project. Of course, the amount of load following that we're going to be allowed to undertake is dependent upon the environmental studies. There may be times of the year, if salmon are spawning, that we're more constrained than at other times. So we would like to be able to do that. And just for information's sake here, if we had an emergency situation, right now we're showing we would probably be averaging on this particular day on the order of 250 megawatts, but there's enough energy in that 1.1 million megawatt hours that we have during the wintertime to run this project any way we want, assuming that we're within the constraints. So if we lost units in the system, we could crank that product up to 600 megawatts for an hour, for 2 hours, for a day, for 2 days, for 10 days, whatever it is that we need. So that's the advantage of hydro and the ability to load follow. Of course, it's all dependent upon making sure that we're not in violation of any of the environmental requirements that we're going to have.
Absolutely, Representative.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it. I wasn't sure if we were going to wait to the end to ask questions, but on this point right here, now I know that looking at the reports, the final reports that we had done in March 16, 2009, and they talked about the different sizes of dams that we can do, and I know that this is an expandable dam, just real quick, why wouldn't we want to do the full dam? What are some of the reasons why we wouldn't want to do that?
Through the chair, the primary purpose, Representative, would be because of cost considerations and demand that we have in the system right now. So we are going to be studying that this year to see what is the optimal size of the dam to go in with. This is not unusual to build a dam and then raise it at some point in the future. So it relates to your system needs. We're going, as I'll talk a little bit about later, we're going to be doing some system studies, and as we get more of the engineering done, this year we'll be able to optimize. But yeah, if we had the demand in the system, then we could certainly go there. But right now we're looking at almost half of the energy that we need in the rail belt being able to be accommodated by a dam that's approximately elevation 2,000. And if you look at what you're looking at, the firm build-out is around 2,180, so it's about another 150 feet higher that you could ultimately go to. And it does offer some advantages, but there's certainly a cost, and you want to make sure that you can accommodate the energy needs too. And we took a relatively conservative approach in terms of the future forecasts. We're looking at an actual decline in energy over the next few years due to conservation methods, and then increases of approximately 0.5% per year through around 2023 when the project would come online.
Okay, and follow, Mr. Chair. And I just want to start off with a comment that I think that we should be building for the future, not just building for the current demand. And I find it hard to believe, we're going to have some more conservation efforts, but we're going to hopefully be planning for more industry, more mines, more development in the state of Alaska. So I think that to say that our demand may go down, I think isn't in the direction that people want to see the state go. And and I don't know if you guys are going to be looking at how much more it would cost to build the full dam rather than the watered down version that we're looking at right now, and how much more bang for the buck that you get just from that little bit, just going that extra 150 feet. But one of the things that you said, and that's the reason I want to stop on the slide for a moment, is the most cost-effective way of delivering this, and I understand you guys are trying to meet the demand loads of at the 50% level, but you said something about keeping the gas is the most efficient way to keep the gas turbine spinning. Can you explain that a little bit further?
Combustion turbines and combined cycle units have an efficiency point. When you vary them a lot to meet the load, you're not operating them as efficiently. So we would like to keep them running at a constant level. If they're generating, every one of these gas-fired units has a most efficient point. We'd like to run them that way. And those are things that we want to work through with the rail belt utilities. The goal here is to keep maximum flexibility for the rail belt utilities.
Okay, and follow up again, Mr. Chair.
Follow up, Representative.
Thank you, appreciate it. And so so which is more efficient, hydro or gas for generating currently, as you see it going forward, What's the most efficient way of delivering electricity? Is it gas or is it hydro?
Through the chair, what we would want to do is use the energy from the project loaded into the system first. That's the way you would normally load it, and then you would add the gas-fired turbines on there to meet the peak demand that you have. And we would recognize the variability of demand during the day, and so with those forecasts, then you anticipate, and then you would run your hydro project and vary it as much as you need to, to meet the load, keeping those gas-fired units at a constant level.
Okay, and follow up, just one quick statement. I would think that we would like to be able to make gas turbines obsolete through hydropower. I mean, that's what I would think, rather than trying to, and I know you're probably trying, I don't know what the ultimate goal here is, but I can tell you that I have this silly little book called The Idiot's Guide to Oil and Gas Politics, and it's written by the Alpha Group, and one of the things that they say in this book, and the Alpha Group is the Rothschilds, and so when you read this, they don't want to see hydro projects ever build more than the current capacity of, or current demand of the society. And the reason why, I believe, is because they want to make sure that the oil and gas industry are still able to have a foothold in power generation. And I'm not saying that you guys thought of it that far out, but I just can't help but to wonder that we're not still somehow, some way catering to the oil and gas industry rather than trying to go. And I know that this committee had passed, and the state legislature, the 26th Alaska State Legislature, passed the first energy policy of the state of Alaska, and that's to get that 50% renewables by 2025. I hope that we do not lose the vision of building the big dam, and I don't know, where we're going to be going on that, but that's the vision I would like to see.
Through the chair, what we have done is define a study area that will allow us to go through to the larger size dam, and we are studying the different elevations this year. So in our feasibility report that we'll have at the end of the year, we'll have all this information laid out. What's the cost? What's the additional energy that you have? So an informed decision could be made.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it.
Thank you. And for the record, I just wanted to note Representative Pruitt is the co-chair of Energy here. And also we have joining us earlier Representative Bob Lynn. And then I just wanted to also note in the audience we have Jim Posey, the CEO of MLNP. And so thank you for being here. Question, Representative Lynn.
I think you may have answered part of it already after I raised my hand to speak. But I assume that the currently proposed dam, smaller dam, it will be built, engineered in such a way that it'd be simple, or nothing is simple, but to accommodate the larger dam at some point in the future, so you don't have to start at ground zero. You can just, the connection parts of that dam would be there.
Through the chair, sir, if you could go back to the configuration of the dam, that one.
And you may have covered that too before I came in.
Through the chair, absolutely, Representative. The way we're siting the powerhouse, if you look at the dam, the powerhouse is sited at the downstream end, and we could easily accommodate building up. So the incremental cost to build the dam as we have it is at an absolute minimum. There's very little additional cost to build the current, and then to raise it, we have all the space. And if we go with the roller compacted concrete, you just go on the back side of the dam and you build the extra 180 feet onto it.
Thank you.
Please proceed. Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. You were talking a second ago about integrating the current natural gas produced electricity into the system. Wouldn't we also be able to use wind power electricity? Isn't it more easily integrated with hydropower?
Through the chair, Representative, that is exactly right. We would be able to utilize the wind energy that's available, and hydro is a very effective means of integrating wind into the system. In the lower 48, they have had some challenges with integration. Having hydro in the system really allows you to improve the integration of the wind projects.
Thank you.
Representative Tuck, did you have a follow-up to his question?
Yeah, through the chair, Representative Peterson, I did want to mention, too, that the other things that AEA are doing with respect to the Rail Belt energy future is the Golden Valley Electric Association is pursuing Eva Creek Wind, and Chugach Electric and SERI are working on the Fire Island Wind project. The Alaska Energy Authority is also working with the Rail Belt utilities in order to develop a wind integration study to do exactly what you're talking about, is to make sure that we can maximize the renewable power that's available and make sure that it's integrated effectively into the system.
Thank you. Representative Pruitt.
The FERC application, which you guys are in the process of, and I know you're about to get to that, but I wanted to kind of address one of the things that Representative Tuck, you know, talking about the expansion and when you file your initial permit application, you're not just filing for one particular dam. There's probably several different options that you have to lay out for them as potential, and that would include potentially something that would be bigger or a different. Am I correct on that? And please, if you would just expound on that.
Through the chair, what we did was file a preliminary application document that gives us full flexibility to go to the large dam. So what, at some point when we file our license application, before that we'll have to make a decision as to what size dam do we want. Our goal is to try to firm that up by the end of 2012, so that the application, you know, gets filed with whatever project that's decided upon. And if it's decided that we start with the smaller dam, and at some point you want to go to the larger dam, then you file a license amendment. And it's a lot easier process to do the license amendment than it is to do the original license for a project.
And follow up on that.
Follow up?
And you say that, of course, the determination has to be made by the end of the year. You say we. Who is the determinant?
Sarah, would you like to answer that?
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Pruitt, the team is moving towards all of these activities with respect to analyzing on the engineering side, the environmental analysis. So the team led by Wayne my input will be working with the board of directors with respect to making those final decisions on what size is the appropriate size and what this project should look like, and of course working on the cost information. So it's a team effort with, of course, the board of directors involved, and then of course the administration.
So just to clarify, basically we've given the AEA the authority along with the administration to make that determination. And it's not something that we have to then turn around and inject our thought process in on that, or certain legislation on that. Correct,
Mr. Chairman. The process will of course include the legislature, because one thing that we will be back at the legislature for is funding. So we will of course have to make decisions and recommendations. So any funding requests that we would have would be based. You would be involved in that process based on the funding needs that we will have, and the financing plan. So, it's not that you're removed from the process, but I'm hoping that when we get to that point, we'll be presenting what we think is the technically and optimal project to move forward, and coming up with a collective plan. And of course, we are part of the governor's executive budget act process. So. It really is truly, led through that process with AEA, working through the administration and then working with the legislature.
Right, Mr. Chairman. Yeah, and I understand of course the funding, you'd have to come back to us. I was just for purposes of your filing of your FERC permit by the end of the year, that would be something that you guys under the studies that you have done along with the administration will make that determination. Of course, then after that, the funding, and that's where you have to then come to us. Do I understand that correct?
Mr. Chairman, I think if we let Wayne get through a couple more slides, there's some Gantt charts that I think will show you kind of where some of these decision points are and where we're at with the project.
Please proceed, Wayne. Thank you.
As we look back on what we've accomplished, I'll just briefly summarize these key items. So this past fall, we opened a product office and we hired very qualified staff. Emily behind me has been introduced. Brian Carey, my product engineer, is on the call. Another one I wanted to bring to our attention is our environmental manager. We have an excellent environmental manager, and we have an administrative assistant. Then, of course, I tap into the expertise in contracting, you know, legal, other administrative needs that we have through the Alaska Energy Authority. So we have a very seasoned staff that we're working with, and I'm very pleased with them. In addition to that, we have what I call the A-team for consultants. We have world-class consultants in engineering, environmental, and counsel. One of the things that we did this past year was we completed for the environmental information a data gap analysis. So what we did was we looked at all the information that was available in the 1980s for the different environmental resources, asked ourselves what we had, and what information do we need on a going forward basis. And that sets the stage for the environmental studies. We also did a mapping of the Susitna River, drainage. We didn't do a lot of geotechnical drilling because that's the one area that hasn't really changed since the 1980s. That's all very, very valuable, and a great deal of money was spent on the geotechnical. So we have huge savings, quite frankly, on a going forward basis with the geotechnical drilling. On October 27th of this past year, we filed our preliminary permit application with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. Before then and since then, we've been quite busy with public outreach, making sure that people know about the project, consulting with stakeholders, in particular having agency workshops. And we had a site visit back in August, and that was with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, and doing presentations. So we've been working very hard in public outreach, but we have lots more to do to make sure that we inform the citizens of the state. Perhaps the most notable accomplishment for the year, though, was when we filed the pre-application document with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission just before the end of the year on December 29th. It's a pretty formidable document. It's several hundred pages long, and it has a description of where we are on the project engineering, how we propose to work forward with the participants, and then a lot of information on the environment and the studies that we plan to be taking. Okay, now we start looking ahead here. This next slide is really for this coming year, and I'll talk a little bit about the licensing status. At the very top in the light green shows that we filed the PAD at the end of December, and then the first item is Alaska Native consultation. The Federal Energy Regulatory Commission will be conducting government-to-government consultation with the Alaska Native entities, but we also have been consulting with them. They're critical on a going-forward basis. There's a lot of cultural issues that we need to work with them on. They're landowners in the area, so it's important that we work with them, and we'll be getting permits to conduct some of the studies, and then ultimately we'll need to have an agreement with them as landholders in the area. Under there's a scoping document that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission produces, and that is expected to be out on February 27th. And then a month later, they will have a series of meetings. Typically, they only have a couple of meetings, but in our discussions with them, we've asked them to make sure that they broaden their meetings. So we now have meetings scheduled on March 27th for Anchorage and Wasilla. The 28th is Talkeetna, the 29th is Fairbanks, and the 30th is Glen Allen. We want to make sure we reach as many people in Alaska as we can. It would have been nice to have had an evening meeting in Anchorage, but the 26th is a holiday. And so we felt like, okay, let's get as much done as we can in 4 days. So that's very important to folks to participate, because FERC comes up here and they want to understand what are the issues that are important to the people in the state.
I have a question from Representative Sadler.
Thank you very much, Chair. Wayne, a brief question. You just mentioned maybe in passing consultations with Alaska Natives. Is that actually a formal government-to-government? Or is that just with Native corporations or Native landholders? Or
through the chair, it is government to government for what the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission and the federal government considers as recognized tribes, using the lower 48 terminology.
Okay, and I just know that raises sovereignty questions, and that raises a whole different thing And that was the federal government to the
Through the chair, yes.
Okay. And which tribes are involved in this? Which
there are a number of tribes. I think if it would be better if we had our attorney Brian Bjorkrest, who's been working very closely on this issue, to respond to it.
At the right time, if Brian's coming up later in the presentation, that'd be fine.
Through the chair, he is available. He's online right now for questions such as this.
I guess I'd ask the question. It might add a new wrinkle. I didn't think we had to consult with the natives on a government-to-government basis on this kind of thing. So I just wonder if that might create any new hoops or delays or what the timeline is.
Brian, are you online there?
Yes, for the record, I'm Brian Bjorkvist. I'm a senior assistant attorney general with the Department of Law. The government-to-government obligations arise out of FERC and their federal requirements. Basically, the using lower 48 tribal entities are the villages. They are not the ANCSA corporations or the ANCSA village corporations.
Okay. And just give me a sample or two of, if you would, Brian, of which tribal organizations you're consulting with or they're working with.
Through the chair, representative. One example would be the Native Village of Cantwell.
Okay. Is Chickaloon involved in that?
Through the chair, yes, representative. Chickaloon Village would be, but not the Chickaloon Moose Creek ANCSA Village Corporation.
Okay. Thank you, Brian.
And we have a question from Representative Pete Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Brian, I've actually heard that there's a land dispute between Siri and the Nilchik Corporation, and that this might have an effect on this project. Could you talk us through what the potential that has to slow this project down?
Through the chair, representative, under the Siri settlement, Siri obtained title to certain lands that are going to be associated with the project. Specifically, there's lands at the dam site and part of the reservoir, and there are also lands that have been conveyed to Siri that would be in at least some of the corridors, the transmission and transportation corridors that are being contemplated. Those lands have been conveyed to Siri already. Siri then has certain obligations under ANCSA and the Siri settlement associated with ANCSA to convey the surface estate of certain lands to the village corporations, the ANCSA village corporations. Some lands have already been conveyed. For example, some lands have been conveyed to the Tayona Corporation and also to the, I'm going to mispronounce this, but the Kanik Village Corporation. In addition, there are going to be some ongoing obligations under ANCSA for that will give entitlements to certain village corporations to obtain some more of the title. And so the title issues are likely to be changing as we go forward. I'm not sure that I would characterize any of those title issues as creating barriers or real difficulties. They are certainly create an opportunity or an obligation for negotiating with the landowners and negotiating appropriate rights to develop the project in the area. And we, the Alaska Energy Authority, is anticipating starting those direct communications in the next week or so. Have already had some, but intend to start discussing in earnest in the next week or so.
Follow up. Thank you. And do you know of any other native allotment cases that are pending that may come into play in the planning of this project?
Through the chair, representative, in the vicinity of the project, my understanding is that there are certain native allotments located there, and there's going to be efforts made, for example, in the road and transmission corridors to avoid them to the extent that's possible. And so that, I think, is the strategy at this point. But there are some in the vicinity, but I don't know that any are located in what necessarily would be the project area.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you. I mentioned the FERC scoping meetings at the end of March, and then the bulk of this year in the formal FERC process is really being taken up with developing detailed study plans. The next big deliverable for us is June 11th, where we need to file with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission our detailed study plans. That'll be a formidable document. We're working with participants, and we're laying out the studies. So that we don't lose time, though, this year we're also conducting a number of field studies to make sure we have information that is going to be relevant to the application that we ultimately file. And that's because we don't want to, slow the process. And we know there's basic information in a number of areas, and the resource agencies and Alaska Native entities and NGOs that have been working with us have been very good in helping us to find these 2012 studies. So I'll work here first with the engineering studies that we plan to conduct this year. I'll just highlight some of the key things. We are very fortunate at the Gold Creek Gauging Station. We have 56 years worth of data. That's huge for almost every single, compared to every single hydro product that's been constructed. You just don't get that kind of level of data. So that's just wonderful. So that really helps us understand the hydrology. We have been able to, look at the effects of climate change on flows. We're using that information for our power operations. We feel very comfortable that we have very good data to work from to estimate the number of megawatt hours that we're going to be able to generate from the project. As you probably are aware, a few years ago, the Alaska Energy Authority conducted an integrated resources plan for the rail belt. We call it the RIRP, and we're going to be making some runs to update that specific for this project. And that'll help us in our planning process as we go through the process of trying to select the optimal project. We're also going to be looking at the layout and trying to optimize the design, and that includes the different elevations. It includes the sizing of the units. Another key part of our studies this year from an engineering perspective is our transmission system reliability and stability modeling work that we're going to be doing. And that's going to have value not just for this product, because it really shows how it interconnects with the interdive, but it will actually have value. And we're working with other parts of the Alaska Energy Authority that are looking at the backbone of the interdive. So it will give us valuable information for what upgrades are necessary to the intertie. There aren't a lot of geotechnical investigations that are going to be necessary this year because we have such great data. The primary elements of the geotech investigations are really to help us with some of the setting of the borough areas and quarries that we're going to be needing. One of the things that's important to me, and also I think to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, is bringing on a board of consultants and for the engineering, and we want to do this early. A lot of times you bring these boards of consultants on later in the process to help with the design, but we think that it's valuable to get that insight now, because by bringing them up at the front end, it's going to allow us to make better decisions going forward and hopefully get the best project possible. We're going to be looking at expertise in seismicity, geotechnical, hydraulics, and then a general engineer that knows how to build these things. The next bullet there is updating the construction cost estimates. Next week, I actually expect to get my first update. It's still a level 4 engineering estimate, and I'd like to be quoting numbers in terms of the ranges, not a specific number. The number that we're going to get, it's going to be plus 50%, minus 30%. So it's still a wide range, but it's something that we don't want to mislead people into. We want people to understand the genesis of that estimate. And then lastly, this year we're going to be working very, very hard with our engineering consultant to complete that feasibility report. Not to be outdone, the 2012 environmental studies are going to be very formidable here as well. We need to understand, the sediment transport. A lot of studies were done in the 80s on that, but we're collecting additional information. Ice is a an area that we have to truly understand, because you're going to be having water that's warmer coming out of the dam. It's going to be instead of 0 degrees coming out in the wintertime, it's probably going to be anywhere from 2 degrees Celsius to 4, so 1 or 2 degrees Fahrenheit to 6 degrees, 33 to 34 degrees Fahrenheit to about 35. And so we want to understand how ice forms, and then how we might operate the project to make sure we have a stable ice cover. Operation studies are both necessary for the engineering as well as the environment. Then collecting baseline water quality information. We have a wealth of fisheries information, but we need to update that. Certainly the salmon are very important species. We're going to be collecting data there. Wildlife. Information on moose, caribou, and other wildlife species. And then on a botanical side, we need to have information on where the wetlands are. Are they different? Unfortunately, there was from the 80s to today, they have changes in how they measure wetlands. So we have to redo those studies. And then cultural resources, as I mentioned earlier, that's an important issue for the Alaska Native entities. It's an important issue for FERC, and it's an important issue for us to be looking at. And then the last is recreation.
We have a question from Representative Sadler.
Thank you. I'm glad to stop you at that point in this slide. You said that earlier that a lot of the geotechnical drilling work you had from past efforts was still valid, was still reliable, was still useful. How much of the environmental studies that you have to do? Is there any residual value from what was done before?
Through the chair, yes. I think there's great value in that information. It will help us, if nothing else, with looking at trends, what's happened from the 80s to today. But unfortunately, folks want to see what's out there today. So we're going to be spending significant dollars in trying to understand the situation as it is today. And I think that'll be hugely valuable for the state in and of itself, though.
Well, there's no savings. There's not much savings at all.
Through the chair. Probably not if I start looking at the cost of these studies relative to the cost of some of the studies that were done in the 80s. We have to collect baseline information for water quality. We're going to be looking at fairly significant fisheries studies here. But I think that information does have value. The cultural resources, we may have some savings there. We're trying to relocate those sites. So that things that are static, that should be savings.
Thank
and
you.
This is kind of the big picture slide here, and I hope I can do justice to it on this Gantt chart here. So I'll try to walk you through it, and if I confuse you, please don't hesitate to interrupt me. That first task, we filed the notice of intent and the pre-application document that kicks off everything. I mentioned the level 4 cost estimate, that should be available to us next week. Our consultant's been working very, very hard on that. Conducting informal studies. I did mention that we're conducting these 2012 studies. We're calling them informal, but they're going to be valuable for the application. And then at the end of this year, it is our expectation that on November 30th, FERC will review our study plan and approve it. And if there are differences, we'll have to work through the next couple of months to resolve differences, but that's our goal. We'll have, by the end of this 2012, a completed engineering feasibility study that will lay things out a lot more with a lot more clarity. And then we want to check back in with you. We have enough monies to last us for the licensing through this fiscal year and next fiscal year, but we're going to need to come back to the next legislature. But it's not going. We're going to be getting our ducks together and putting that information in early this summer. Once we get our first draft of the study plan in June, we'll have a really good idea of the cost of all of the studies. We've actually itemized the studies now and put our best guess, but until you put the details to that, you won't know that. So we'll have this summer good information to let you know what the needs are for the licensing and final design. We've got some cash flow numbers that we've been working with for that, so we'll have that available to you. Item number 8 there is possibly coming back to you for an appropriation for a state investment in the project, more than just the licensing. I'll just leave it at that. And then the next couple of years we'll be conducting the FERC-approved studies. As we go through that process, we'll begin to prepare the license application, and the goal now is to file the license application in September of 2015, and that is through following this integrated licensing process that we have selected. So it's a few years out there, but what we would like to try to achieve before we file that is to have a settlement agreement with the stakeholders, or at least with as many stakeholders as we can, in particular the resource agencies and the Alaska Native entities, and hopefully many of the NGOs that are participating in the project. Another big item on our task list is negotiating power sales agreements with rail belt utilities. We need to sit down with them. We've been talking to them. We need to communicate more with them. And the plan is to talk on a monthly basis to the rail belt utility managers, and then at a similar basis or as frequently as necessary on a technical level to make sure we're all working together on this. You see the next item is final engineering design. The whole goal here is to try to be online by the end of 2023. To do that, we need to do the final engineering design, and that should get started around the middle of next year. So we want to lay out our plan for doing that in a little bit more detail for Sarah, for the board, and ultimately for the legislature here. Once we file our application, of course, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission is going to need some time to do its processing and prepare their National Environmental Policy Act document. Our goal is to give them such a high-quality document that all they have to do is change the cover from our cover to their cover. It's our goal. And then the plan would be to have our license by January of 2017, and then to immediately begin construction so that we can finish it in 2023. The last aspect that I haven't talked about is the project financing, and we're actually starting to think through how to finance it. Right now we've had some preliminary discussions with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, the Rural Utility Services. One of the advantages of financing through them is if we were able to finance this project today, we could probably be financing $1 billion or maybe even as much as $2 billion at 3% monies. Most of our studies have been looking at 6-7% in terms of financing. That would be a huge saving for a project like this.
Okay. Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just wondering, you've gone to the fast track on the licensing process, and I understand why you've done that, so that we can try to get the project completed, before our 2025 goal. Do you think that's a realistic expectation that we'll be able to meet the deadlines?
Through the chair, Representative. We are going to go as quickly as we can. We need to make sure we collect the appropriate information. FERC spent a lot of time developing the integrated licensing process, albeit it was primarily for relicensing, but they also developed that for new projects as well. And so given that we have lots of information to work with, I fully expect that we'll be doing our part to meet that schedule. There's always a risk associated with folks saying you're going too fast for us. Let's slow it down. But what we're taking the burden ourselves on to make sure we have the necessary information available to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission so that they can make a timely filing.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you.
That concludes my presentation.
Thank you so very much, Representative Sadler.
Thank you. Question for you, Wayne. I do know you've done some public outreach and some public things. You've got through the FERC process other outreach. Have you been able to tell me what efforts you've made to make the case to Alaskans about the financial benefits of this? I know that you're talking a little about the process, the environmental work, the cultural, so forth, but are you making the case as to why this is a good deal for Alaskans?
Through the chair, I think we have more work to do on that element. We are planning to undertake some studies to evaluate the benefits. There are certainly items that we could speak to in the report that we provided to you. We had some assumptions in terms of what power costs could be. But there's also, you know, other aspects of you know, jobs that would be created during the construction, and then the aspect of the value of you know, low cost energy to Alaskans for generations. I think more work needs to be done there.
Thank you. Through the chair, Representative Sadler, there's a lot of moving parts and pieces, especially in this 2012, and that includes what you have mentioned. And part of the issue is making sure that we have this level four cost estimate. And Wayne's you know, very correct. You know, we've been using a number as an estimate, but we haven't been using a range. And so we really need to take a look at what the range of the cost of this power project could be. And actually, back to something that Representative Tuck had said earlier, is we are looking at and analyzing the size of this project. Is this going to meet it? So we've got all of these studies and modeling that needs to be done this year, and I think to help sell the case with respect to that, this is a project that will provide long-term stable cost of power for the Rail Belt region, and we need to start putting the details on that and more than what we've had already published. And I think the key point is to start with this cost estimate and these studies, and looking at, as Wayne had mentioned, potential financing options with low interest rates.
I think there is a good case to be made, and of course everyone wants to have all the information, you know, right away, and you're actually in the middle of, you know, designing the permit application process, but I think there should be real benefits, and that might be part of your message to people.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Appreciate it. And if you need any help with that, I'd be more than happy to help promote this dam, because I'm really excited to see a project like this taking place. And I know that Alaskans have been, you know, studying this, and I know in the 80s we almost went forward with it, but I think natural gas prices dropped so low, it just, you know, why do it at that time? But as we know now, we're so volatile with natural gas prices especially, and then with the high price of oil keep going up and up. I'm glad that we're looking at hydro again. I'm a big fan of hydro. That's the reason I'd like to build a big project if we can. And and with that, just to make sure I understand, so when we go in this FERC filing process, our deadline to potentially go ahead and expand, and now there's two things here. One of them is to go ahead and make the decision to either build a big one or build the expandable one. Right, and then if I heard you correctly, December is the deadline on whether or not we build the big one or the expandable one, or is it to build the expandable one and we still have some time to change our mind down the road to build the big one on top of the expandable?
Through the chair, we would like to be able to make the decision for the FERC application by the end of 2012. The reason being, it affects the studies that you're going to be, you know, undertaken, and it's always a challenge if you make the decision down the road to pull everything together. And I think we should be, we have to ask ourselves the question, what information are we going to have at the end of this year that's going to help us make that decision versus the following year that's going to help make that decision? And I think the following year we'll have a little bit more on an environmental information, but from an engineering perspective, we'll have what we need. I doubt that we would have a year from then additional information on load growth. There may be some information on that, but I would hope what information we have we can put to good use at this year. So the goal would be to make the decision, you know, next year. If we decide that we want to hold off, that's not the end of the world. We could even last another year. When we start working on the application itself, though, we should have the decision made by then. And sir, if you could go to the probably, yeah, this one here where it shows the license application, item number 10, prepare and file, you know, license application. So it's really not till sometime around the middle of 2013 that we're going to, you know, start preparing that. I would like to have a decision made as early as possible, but if we're uncomfortable with making that decision, then we could probably hold off until we start the application. But once you start the application, you really need to freeze the design at that point.
Okay, and Mr. Chair, thank you. If we do decide to go on the expandable one, and that's our decision at the end of this year. And we go forth with the FERC filing and the process there. If we decide to go ahead and expand on that through the middle of our FERC filing, is there an opportunity to do that, or do we have to start all over with FERC?
Through the chair, we don't have to start all over with FERC because the preliminary application document has laid out those alternatives. It just would slow down probably the timing of the actual filing if we decided to do that. So it's not like you start over again. We just have to do what's necessary. There could be some. There would likely be some time delay in it, though.
Okay. And then another additional question. If we were to build the go ahead and start the project, we're under construction, and we build the expandable one. And once we're in the construction phases, do we have to start over again, do the FERC filing, if we then decide to go ahead and go with the big one? In other words, this FERC filing, does it cover both? I know we have the expandable base, but will it also cover if we decide to expand? I guess is what I'm getting at.
Yeah, through the chair, we would get a license to build the project for what we have actually applied for, and to the extent that FERC has modified the license, and they typically don't modify the design, but they may put some constraints on the license itself. So that's what we're allowed to construct, and then we need to get the as you go along. You get your license. You don't just get the carte blanche to go and build. We're checking in with FERC during the process as well. But if we decided at some point that we would want to go with a larger dam, then we would have to file a license amendment with FERC. That doesn't mean that you'd stop the construction that you're undergoing. We just have to file a license. And that process is also a three-stage licensing process where you prepare a pre-application document similar to what we did, the PAD, and then you go through a pre-filing application process, and then FERC does another NEPA document on it. So it's not starting the price. Theoretically, that should go fairly quickly. I have seen some of those amendments go quickly. But if there is a lot of new information, that could be a relatively time-consuming process as well.
Okay. And just a quick comment, Mr. Sure. Chair. Thanks. I appreciate that. That just gives me another reason why I'd say we'd build a big one. But I look in reviewing the study that was done in 2009 for the Alaska Energy Authority. If you look at the cost and the megawatt generation, we have Wantana, the big one. It will be generated 1.2 megawatts, according to this, at an $8.4 billion cost. But if we do the lower one, that's half the megawatt capacity, 600 megawatt, at $6.9 billion. So just roughly about 22% more increase in cost, we'll get over 200% more power generation. And that's what I'm trying to get at. Just bang for the buck. Once we start this thing, I don't see why we don't just go ahead and go with the big one. The document further says that hydroelectric power has many economic and environmental benefits, including long-term rate stabilization. Because the cost of the water to power a hydroelectric turbine is essentially free, the cost per kilowatt hour is related to the construction and maintenance cost of the dam and powerhouse facilities. So as we have seen recently, the price of fossil fuels can fluctuate dramatically over time, whereas the cost of hydroelectric power decreases once the initial investment has been repaid. So I guess my ultimate question is, is it the fear that we would not fund the full $8.4 billion and why we wouldn't do the full dam? I mean, everything I look at is why not? It even goes further to say that the best bang for the buck is the Wantana Devil Canyon, which is generating 1.8 gigawatts of power.
Through the chair, Representative Tuck, as we discussed last year too, when the legislation was passing, there was the looking for a project that would roughly provide 50% of renewable energy for the railroad and essentially the state. I think all of those issues are things that we are considering and looking at with respect to the right size. There's a lot of players involved in this, including the utilities that would eventually be, again, looking back at what we've used the term the Bradley model on the utilities paying through a power sales agreement, the debt payments. Those are things we need to consider, and we need to consider what the utilities through the runs with the IRP and working with the utilities with respect to the amount of power that they can purchase from this project. So there again, it's a lot of parts and pieces, including in this for the size and the amount of power that's needed. The power sales agreement and the utility interaction is really important again for this year as we look through these things.
Follow up, Representative. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, I can't imagine a utility not wanting to support a big hydro project. I mean, I find that hard to fathom. And when you talk about 50% renewable, that's just the minimum. I mean, that's our goal. We would like mm-hmm. to go beyond that, if all possible. Again, getting ourselves off the reliance of oil and gas for power generation. And when you look at the project timeline, it's only one additional year to do the full 1.2 megawatts. So I hope we continue to look at this as we go forward. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. And I have a question, and then we have Representatives Sadler and Peterson. Question, last year, during some of the public events that were held, there's some concern about being able to provide input, and I think somebody had mentioned something about, you know, maybe just being able to write their questions on cards and not being able to, and I don't know if it's because there are a lot of people there and whatnot, but I was just curious about the format of the public scoping meetings. And, you know, to what extent will people be able to provide their inputs?
And, Mr. Chairman, I'm actually glad you mentioned that because we did spend a lot of time last year, and I just want to refresh everybody's memory. And actually, Wayne was not on board when we were doing this. The Alaska Energy Authority had issued the preliminary decision document that had shown that the Susitna project is the project that we should proceed. And what we did at that point is in February of last year, we had a series of public meetings throughout the rail belt to discuss that. The format that was used at that time was a bit more of a, it was a presentation and it was not, I guess, an open dialogue. And there were folks that had written down questions and were not, there are folks, and especially in Talkeetna, were not particularly happy about that format. One of the first things that we did this summer in the end of August is we did have a site visit with the resource agencies, and we held a public meeting in Talkeetna. And essentially that meeting, the folks in Talkeetna were very very cordial and very, very, very respectful. It was a very good meeting, and we did the format that they wanted. There was a lineup of several of us up in front of the room, and we fielded questions. That's what they wanted. They didn't want any presentations at that point. They just wanted us to answer their questions. And our team spent approximately two and a half hours working in that format and working through some of the questions and the issues that were raised by the residents of that area. I'm going to have Wayne talk to you a bit more about the public scoping meetings because it is important. This is another opportunity to have public input and provide comments to FERC and also follow up for written comments.
Thank you. Wayne?
Mr. Chairman, the way the FERC will handle the scoping meetings, and I'll talk about the public meetings primarily here, is they'll, and again, this is their meeting, not ours. But they typically allow the applicant to give a presentation on the project. So I fully expect that we will be allowed to, you know, present some information on the project, and then they take they'll discuss their process for going through their NEPA process and when they would timeline when they would expect to be making a licensing decision. And then they open it up for public comment. And you're typically allowed 3 to 5 minutes. Now, sometimes the FERC has a time limit for when they take those public comments. But earlier in my career, I also was a consultant to FERC, and I stayed up till 2 o'clock in the morning listening to people's comments. And I would hope that they would do that in this particular case. I'll certainly be whispering in the project manager's ear from the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission that we want to give everybody a chance to speak that wants to speak. And then there's an opportunity, you know, after the meeting, 30 days to submit written comments to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission on the issues that are of interest to people.
Thank you. Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm going to ask you to turn back to the Gantt chart, which is packed with great information about the schedule going forward. I'm going to invite you to expand a little bit. There's a lot of technical terms, a lot of studies. Would you mind going through that one more time, amplifying a little bit what the process is going forward?
Yeah,
not just from a public scoping and public input, but just the regulatory, the licensing, the studies.
Through the chair, yes. The way the process works, the pre-application document kicks off the formal, you know, licensing process. That's also called your pre-filing consultation. And FERC has a very formalized process to meet with the participants and develop study plans. And it's almost a whole year to get those study plans approved by FERC. So we will have filed December 29th, and we're expecting FERC will make their decision on the studies on November 30th, so 11-month period. And then the following year, we would be implementing, you know, those studies. And you do, and this is the formal process, you do a one-year study with all of the resources, and then you complete a report, which is your initial study report, and you meet with all of the participants, and maybe you'll modify the studies that you did that year that you had planned for the subsequent year, and that takes a month or two to go through that and make sure you're all on the same page. And if there's any disputes, then FERC would come in and arbitrate those disputes. And then, so our second year of studies would be 2014.
And if the extent you can refer to that, that'd be great.
Sure. If I could point with this, hopefully not get in anybody's. Can you look at this?
Yes.
Okay. So I apologize.
Blind our chairman.
I'm so used to this. I mean, the eyes in the back of our heads here. So right here is the 2 years that we have for conducting the FERC-approved studies. Okay, and in that time period, you're doing a 1 year's worth of study. You write very detailed study reports that goes to all the agencies. They get a chance to comment on that, and then maybe suggest some modifications to those studies. And then you go back the second year and you finish those off. Okay, so if I go to the to one behind that, we would like to, under the prepare and file the license application, after the first year of studies, I think there's enough good information, you start your application there to get a head start. Because the second year of studies are typically confirmatory, studies. And we will have the 2012 studies, and then we will have that major 2013 year of studies to use as the basis of the application, and then we'll be preparing that. I think once you get that first year of formal studies, you'll know enough about this that you want to sit down, and that's when you really start the negotiations with the stakeholders and coming up with a settlement agreement.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And then you would file, and if you go to item number, I don't want to point this because I don't want to get in anybody's eyes. So if you go down to item number, 14, I guess, the FERC NEPA process, that really kicks off, and we're anticipating that we'll file that application, and it's difficult to see on this, but that date, trigger date, is September of 2015 that starts that process, and then we're anticipating that it's going to take FERC from then till around the end of 2016 to complete, their process. And as I said earlier, it's our plan to give them a very well documented application that's going to allow them to go a little quicker through their review process to initiate. Then they'll file the draft environmental impact statement during that period of time, get comments, and then file a final environmental impact statement, and then they can issue the license.
follow up?
I don't see the 2 years for the environmental lawsuits, however. Is it factored in some factor?
Oh.
Actually, being serious, though, is there any accommodation for expected litigation of the permits and the design? Does all work?
Yeah, through the chair, I think this would be a good time for our counsel, Van Ness Feldman, to make a comment on that. Mike Swagger, are you available?
Yeah. What about Tom Roberts? Is he also somebody who could answer that?
I'm on the line, Wayne.
This is Mike.
Oh, Mike. Mike, okay, if you could just state your name and affiliation for the record, please, and proceed.
Yes, this is Mike Swagger. I'm with the law firm of Van Ness Feldman in Washington, D.C., and we are outside counsel to AEA on the project.
Thank you. Please proceed.
There is always the possibility of litigation. But the litigation really can't occur until, you know, FERC has issued a decision. And that, you know, that's at the end of the process. The FERC process itself leading up to FERC's licensing order typically does not get interrupted by litigation. Someone could challenge the license. Just because there's a challenge to the license, though, that doesn't necessarily mean the project can't go forward, because a challenge to a FERC license does not necessarily result in a stay of the license. So someone challenging the project would have to go a step further and actually get a FERC or a court to issue a stay of the license decision. Hopefully we'll avoid that by meeting everybody's concerns and not having major challenges, but certainly that's always there as a possibility at the end of the road. The process for challenging the FERC license is a petition for review in the Court of Appeals, the U.S. Court of Appeals, and that process typically takes a couple of years. So I think, you know, at worst, if someone challenged the FERC license and was able to get a stay of the license order, it might hold things up for a couple of years.
Okay. I'm not being pessimistic. I'm just asking if there was any accommodation for that kind of stuff. So. But it would come at the end of the process, which would be at the end of 2000.
It would come at the end, right. So it's not really part of the FERC process itself, but it's at, you know, after the FERC process is complete.
Okay. Good. Thank you.
I see the construction completion is 2023 and the goal is 2025, so I figure those 2 years right there must be the Representative Peterson, question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. As long as we had the gentleman on the phone, I was going to ask him if he foresees that there might need to be some land acquired through eminent domain, and would this slow down the acquiring the area that we're going to need to build this dam?
I don't know offhand, and Brian Bjorkquist may know the answer as to whether AEA would have quick take authority under state law. And if it does, then the eminent domain actually doesn't hold up the project. You, under the quick take provision, you acquire the property immediately, and then the only question to be litigated is what you pay. But one interesting thing here is that it appears as though the conveyances to Siri, for example, were made subject to a what's called a power site reservation, which is basically says it's a right of reentry into the formerly federal land to develop a hydro project. So it was conveyed with the understanding that this is a potential hydro site, and the land could be re-entered at some point to build the hydro. So hopefully, we would not need to pull the trigger on eminent domain.
Okay. And one other comment is actually an answer to Representative Tuck's question about why the utilities might not want to buy 100% of their power from the dam project. And part of the reason for that would be is they're in the process of constructing brand new natural gas-fired facilities right now that will have a 35- or 40-year life and probably a 30-year payoff. And so they're probably not going to want to shut those and mothball down those and buy power for hydropower from somewhere else. So that's why I think having the ability to expand it later on when those plants used up their useful life makes probably more sense. Because they're going to have to sell the power. They're going to have a power agreement signed with the utilities to get the financing to build this, if I'm correct.
Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And looking through this document, it does have a couple of conditions on it. One of them is that 100% financing would be through bonds, no state investment. The other one is that all energy will be sold. And in the cases, and I'm agreeing with what, in defense of what Ms. Fisher-Gaud said earlier, in defense of what she said, I see that could be a problem because the assumption, again, is all energy will be sold. We know that not all energy will be sold. But the other thing is that the bond rate is at 5% over the term of 50 years and no contribution by the state. We can make contributions with the state to get it more in line to where, it would pay off. And then we can also defer any payments back from the state over a 30, 40-year, 50-year payback, defer that until then and then start getting our return back on our investment on that. So there's still, I think, a way of doing it. But I, in defense of what Fisher-Gaud said, I see the issue there.
And Representative Sadler.
Thank you. A new topic. I just kind of a check-in. Wayne, I'm glad you're back in the job after however many years, but the question I'll ask Sarah actually is, do you have the staff and the resources and the management structure? Is it working well? Is there any impediment to the work you're doing now?
Thank you, Ms. Through the Chair, Representative Sadler. As Wayne had mentioned, a small AEA staff at this point. There is a request for some additional position authorizations for this next year. We're using the existing funds that we have, and I think between the combination of the contractors that we have and also the staff, I think we're in pretty good shape for the project.
If you get the additional staff you plan to ask for, you're saying? Or?
Yeah, I think that is one thing that we're trying to do this in a responsible manner. There's again a lot of work to be done this year. We want to make sure that it does take time to recruit and hire good qualified staff, and I think for the folks that we have, I'm extremely pleased with the team that's been assembled, and I think that we will need some additions on that, especially for some assistant project manager types for the engineering and the environmental managers.
Okay. Well, I'm sure we'll hear the details. Thanks.
Okay, Representative Pruitt, question?
A couple questions. At this point, what we would estimate the design that we're probably looking at is probably the roller compacted concrete, correct? Go ahead.
Through the chair, yeah, yes.
What impact does that have on the initial cost? And then the cost estimates, several years ago, were at a higher rate. But I think we were looking initially at that point at a more standard construction, whereas roller compacted concrete is faster and more efficient. What impact do we think that could play into this? And
through the chair, the plan with roller compacted concrete, it allows you to have less materials, a smaller dam, and therefore you would think quicker. MWH has gone through a very detailed thought process of laying
the schedule out, and I've had a chance, along with my project engineer, Brian Carey, to go through that. That still comes out with, unfortunately, with a 2023, schedule. I would think that cost is a factor. It should be a money saver for us. I can't tell you how much because they've kept that as a closely guarded secret for now, so I'll know in about a week.
And then follow up on that.
Follow up?
And roller compact concrete, from what the opportunity I had over the interim to understand it a little bit better, it's easier to expand roller compacted concrete than it would be some of the other traditional methods, correct?
Through the chair, absolutely. That's the one advantage of a huge advantage I see with roller compacted concrete is when we go to expand the dam, we have it all set up. So you just go in the backside, you can continue operating. You have to take some, safety precautions, some operation precautions, but you can continue to construct while you're still operating the project.
Right. And then another question on that, kind of in that same vein. Of course, we're looking mostly at our utilities as being the people that would purchase the power. Has there been any looking at energy intensive industries or other people that might be able to utilize the power or therefore, help kind of either, I don't know if it's, bring the cost down or somehow be involved with this?
I can take a second. Through the chair, the Rail Belt Integrated Resources Plan has within it a number of potential, large, projects. I think one, dealing with the computer industry, some mining projects, and when you total all those up, it could be as much as another 1,000 megawatts, almost doubling, what we have out there today. So the challenge is to get your crystal ball out and see is one of these going to happen or not. That's why I say if we knew next year or at this time that they were going to happen, then maybe we'd go straight for the large project right away. Or even if they started happening while we were in construction, maybe that's something that we could do at that point as well. The challenge is when you there's a long lead time on particularly your turbines could be 3-4 years lead time for some of those, so you need to be factoring all that into your scheduling. But we've been thinking about those kinds of things. We would like to work more with the utilities to get their sense in terms of what the load growth is going to be, and that's really part of the process as we go through this year. I would like to have it not just be a presentation from Sarah and myself, but really more the utility representatives that are up here with us saying, yes, this is what we think is the best project going forward.
Another follow-up.
And
you kind of hit on the crystal ball and having to look out far. Is there anything, let's see, from 17 until 23, quite as fancy time in construction. And, of course, looking at other dams, last year we talked about Karanuka quite a bit. They permitted, had it built within, I think it's 3 years. You can correct me on that if I'm wrong. Is the construction timeline here, is this kind of an estimate and this is the best option? Is it the option that maybe looks at maybe the longest time frame? I mean, it's quite a 11 years here to get that power, and we are having to look at a crystal ball. There is a lot of guessing that we're having to do. Is there any way to get the process a little bit slimmed down?
Through the chair, it's always a challenge. There's always this pressure to be faster and faster, and I like the concept of the way our consultant MWH has gone through the scheduling. You can only, unfortunately, in Alaska, when it gets really cold, you can't really continue with the construction, the placement of RCC. You can do certain things year-round, like the powers. You can enclose that, but you can't enclose the RCC construction. So that's one of the limiting factors. One of the other factors that we're looking at is the access. Really, you need to have the access first. So to make the schedule work, to some extent, this is an optimistic schedule. I'd love to see the access even before 2017 have that done. Of course, it'd be challenging to do that in trying to have a stakeholder agreement. But if we had a stakeholder agreement, maybe we could go forward with that, because there is no we're not precluded from, you know, building the access road. That is not necessarily something that FERC has to weigh in on. The state may elect to do that on its own.
Chairman, so part of it, so we could actually, if we chose as a state to go ahead and build the access to the facility prior to the licensing, that you're saying that there's a potential that that could cut down on the total time frame here?
Through the chair, yes. And maybe our counsel, Van S. Feldman, could comment on building the access early.
Michael Swiger, are you still on online? Michael Swiger, are you still online?
There we go. I'm here. I was just muted.
Unmute.
Cool. Thank you. Please proceed.
Yes.
It's possible. I think it's something we're still thinking about, and thinking about how to go about doing it.
Can I ask what would be the limitations other than cost
of starting early?
Correct. What would be? Are there limitations based on access issues? I mean, what would be the limitations to building it prior to having the actual licensing?
Well, one limitation would be that if it's going to be part of a licensed project, then you really can't build it without the authority of the license. But if there is an independent justification, and if it's a multi-purpose access road, for example, then it may even not end up being part of the licensed project. And if there's an independent basis or reason for doing it, then that might make sense to do. But you just have to be careful about, the license is the authority to construct, and so you got to be careful about doing anything that could be deemed project construction before you have a license. But, you know, we'd certainly look at all of the options and whether there are other reasons for putting in a road or whatever.
Kind of sounds like a road to resources to me. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Are there any further questions from the committee?
I have one last comment.
Representative Peterson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Having taken a tour of Hoover Dam myself and seen the number of other tourists that were there at the time, and knowing that Alaska is a tourist destination, I think we want to take into account the fact that this will probably be an attraction for tourists, and considering it's numerous years in the future that when this will be completed, we could have even a large number of tourists coming to Alaska then than we do now. So we might want to be prepared to show off our completed dam project.
If you could see Denali from the top of the dam.
We probably could.
Probably could.
We can't see Russia from there. No.
You can see Russia from my district, though. Okay, are there any further questions? Seeing none, Representative Pruitt?
Is there anything you guys need from us before? I mean, we're only here for 90 days. You'll have 9 months, well, Lord willing. We have 9 months that we won't have access. Do you guys need anything from us while we're here to facilitate money? I don't know.
Well, Mr. Co-Chair, I think one thing that we'll be providing you is that these scoping meetings, that these are public meetings, is encouraging folks to participate either by submitting a letter to FERC or actually being able to attend the public scoping meeting in their area. I know it's still during session, but I think that's one place. And again, as far as legislative, we do not need legislation right now, and we do not need funding. As I had mentioned, there is some position authorizations we're looking for And I do appreciate the support from this committee. It was a pleasure. I think I had 7 meetings in front of you with the team last year. Glad that our team is expanding, and it's I really appreciate the support with respect to what AEA is trying to get done this year.
Can I respond? Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to say that I do like I have watched you guys grow over the interim. I'll bring it on Wayne. I think you've made some very positive moves, and I would like to commend you guys on that because you can tell that from where we were last year when we ended the session and where we are now, there has definitely been some progress. And I think it shows, but it's also just – it's vital it's vital for all of us to know that we're on the right track and keeping this thing going. So thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Further questions or comments? Okay, and certainly we do appreciate your time, and thank you for presenting for us here. And the next committee meeting will be held at 3 o'clock on Tuesday, January 31st, next week, and chairing that meeting will be Representative co-chair here, and the committee will be hearing HB 250, an act relating to the Renewable Energy Grant Fund and recommendation program. And so this meeting is adjourned at 4:35 p.m., and thank you all for coming.